I'm thankful to have materialized in front of you all. I've never thought of it in those terms before, but it is a privilege to be here today. I've been in a lot of your houses and or to your assemblies. You're very friendly people, but I have to acknowledge when you're all in a group like this, you're terrifying. What really terrifies me today above everything else, thank you for praying. Obviously, someone was praying this morning. Don't stop. Whatever you're doing, please don't stop praying. Even now, this afternoon, it carried us through this morning. I think we felt the voice of the Lord on us, and we don't want that to stop now. But what terrifies me more than anything is the fact that I have to answer for every word I say someday personally to the Lord Himself. So please, please do not stop praying. Mark 12 will be our text. Mark 12, and we can read from verse 38. It'll give us a little context anyways. Jesus was in the temple. This is his third visit to the temple in Mark's account, and it is very, very close to the looming shadow of the cross. And in verse 38, he said to them in his doctrine, in his teaching, "Beware of the scribes, which love to go in long clothing, and they love salutations, they love greetings in the marketplace, and the chief seats in the synagogues, and the uppermost rooms at the feasts. They also devour widows' houses, and for a pretense they make long prayers. These shall receive greater damnation." Those are strong words, but here is our text for today. Verse 41, "And Jesus sat opposite the treasury, and behold, he beheld how the people cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. There came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites." There really isn't an English equivalent for this currency that we're finding here, but we're going to look at it anyways later on. "She threw in two mites, which make a farthing or a quadrants." Which comes directly from the Greek word behind it, which tells us this currency was specific to the Greek culture. "And he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you," it's true, I'm saying to you, "that this poor widow has cast in more than all they which have cast into the treasury." She's cast in more than all they have cast. "For all they did cast in of their abundance, of their wealth, of all that they have, but she of her want, of her poverty, did cast in all that she had, even all her living." I want to make very clear that this text is a discipleship issue for two reasons. First of all, as we compare it to Luke's account of the very same story, Luke is very matter-of-fact in how he tells it, and Mark's stands out as a discipleship lesson. Because in Luke, as the Lord is watching, it merely says that he looked up, he saw what was going on, and he said. And he gave the lesson. But Mark is a lot more specific. Mark actually tells us that before he spoke about this, he called his disciples. This was a lesson for disciples. It was a discipleship issue. And not only the distinction between Mark and Luke, but it's also emphasized as we see Mark's theme all the way through. I think he could have borrowed Bonhoeffer's title, "The Cost of Discipleship." It is the theme all the way through the Gospel of Mark. I know we look at it as the Gospel of the Perfect Servant, but it goes beyond that. It goes to the obligations that the perfect servant places on those who claim and profess to believe in him. And so for the first seven 8.5 chapters of the Gospel of Mark, we find a very excellent portrait of the perfect servant. And by the time you get to about Mark 8:26, you're wiped out. You're tired. Because there are words that are used over and over again, like immediately. It was just happening in quick fashion as far as Mark was concerned. You're tired by the time you're done. And Jesus is serving humanity. He's the perfect servant. Now imagine this, the Son of God, the King of Kings that Matthew reminds us of, the Son of God that Mark makes very clear, he is the Son of God, comes into the world and serves humanity with patience and with faithfulness and with humility, and he serves perfectly. And one of the key verses in Mark is Mark 10:45 that tells us that the Son of Man did not come to be served, he came to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Well, that's not enough, is it? Because what happens at Mark 27 is it seems that the direction shifts a little bit. It's at this point that Jesus, as he is speaking to his disciples on the way, he asks them, "Who do people say that I am?" And at this point, everything starts to shift towards the disciples. Are you getting this? That's really what he's asking them. Are you watching? Are you getting what I'm doing? Do you see who I am and what I'm doing? And we know Mark 8:36 very clearly. We hear it a lot and more in an evangelism context, but it is a discipleship verse. What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his life? You see, the obligations start to come out on the disciples, and Mark, a failed disciple himself, he knew what it was to fail. He shows the raw material. These disciples, they weren't exactly a success story. As you go through these chapters from 8, the end of 8 on, you see that they just don't get it. Jesus in chapter 10 tells them what was going to happen to him at the cross. And immediately after telling them of all the sufferings he's going to go through and how he is ultimately going to serve, James and John walk up to him and say, "Master, will you give us whatever we ask for?" What did they ask for? They asked for the top seats. James, John, you don't get it. You don't know what it is to be my disciple. So the spotlight turns, and as we read through the Gospel of Mark, it keeps turning, because it's not about those disciples anymore. It's about these disciples now. And as you read, and I read, it becomes very personal. Mark is turning to the readers, and the obligation is becoming very, very clear. His perfect service to me. He gave himself. He gave everything. He lowered himself. He took my sin. He died my death. His service to me demands my surrender to him. And as you come to Mark 11 through to Mark 16, it shifts again, and now it is about the cross. We see the conflict rising as he visits the temple 3 times. This is the last time, and the conflict is intense at this point. The passion of the perfect servant. You see, here we are. We've got all these disciples, and they just don't get it. And they're failures on their own. And you've got over here the perfect service of the Son of God. So we've got these two extremes. How do they come together? They come together in the cross. It's the only way we can serve is by the cross, the power of the cross. That's the only way that we can be his disciples. So Mark brings them together in the ultimate serving of the Lord Jesus at the cross. We heard it this morning. Andrew said it, and he opened. By the way, I wasn't the one who said that, Andrew, to you about you know, the struggle of life. Why bother if I'm going to heaven anyways? Why bother? But I was one of those guys. I struggled with that for a long time. Something was missing. Just knew something wasn't right in the picture that I had. Because the gospel is not merely about saving people from hell. It's about making disciples. That's what the commission tells us to do, is to make disciples, go into all the world, not just see them saved from hell, but make disciples. So I want to ask right now, in your life, check your pulse right now. Are you a disciple? Are you following? Are you learning? Are you serving? Are you seeking Him above all else? Maybe there are some here today, you say, that's not where I am right now. Have you ever been there? Has there been a longing in your heart to detach from the world and follow Him? Are you His disciple? Because if you can't look back in your history and see that, then there is no experience in the world that will ever save you. Mark doesn't detach discipleship from the gospel. A person who is truly converted will follow Christ ultimately. Or in the end, he will say, depart from me, I never knew you. You workers of lawlessness, you weren't working and serving and following me. So are you a disciple? Well, I don't want this to be a discouraging message. I actually want it to be an encouraging message. And so I want to give 6 points today as clearly and as quickly as I can from this picture of this lovely lady. She's not just a poor widow. The Lord sees her as something else. And He says to His disciples, come here, I want you to take a look at this, because this is what a disciple is. So let's have a look today and see if we can get 6 points that you can keep. And hopefully, if you get nothing else from how I explain the points, at least you can take them and follow them yourself. Here's number one. Being a disciple means that there is only one perspective that matters. Only one perspective that matters. Now notice how it begins, because Jesus sits down opposite the treasury. They were set up in the temple, 13 receptacles, trumpet shaped, and there they were, and He sits down. I don't know how far away He was, but He was there. And the word Mark actually uses to show that He was watching, he uses it in an imperfect tense. And it's a wonderful tense, because you can't bring it out in English as well. But it's the idea that He was watching and watching and watching and watching. Now, all the married men here know what I'm talking about, because you've all sat in the shopping mall, right? And, honey, no, feel free to take your time in that store. I'll go sit on the bench out there and enjoy myself. And there's something about, or in the airport, you know, if you travel and you get to sit down, I just love watching people. I think it's very entertaining, very amusing at time, you know. And here is the Lord, and He sits down opposite the treasury, and He's watching on a continuous basis. He's watching and watching and watching. They didn't know He was watching, but He was watching. You see, being a disciple means, and I'm by far not telling you, don't listen to your parents, don't listen to advice of others. I'm not saying that, but I am saying this. Ultimately, at the end of the day, if you are going to be a follower of Jesus Christ, if He is your Lord and Master, at the end of the day, what He says is the final word, and His perspective is the only one ultimately that matters. There are going to be a lot of people that misunderstand you. There are going to be a lot of people saying, I don't get her. Why does He do what He does? I love what Lenski said on this. He said that His all-discerning eyes, just think of that title, His all-discerning eyes rested upon her and upon all that transpired here. This is what made His judgment infallible. So every life and every heart lie bare before Him. And Paul says, we must all appear, be exposed for who we are before the judgment seat of Christ. It's coming. And it would be a good thing if it hasn't happened before today. And if you're living a performance-based life based on what others are thinking about you and everything else. Just remember, at the end of the day, there's one perspective that counts. And I have to stand before Him. You have to stand before Him by yourself. There won't be any others standing there for you or answering for you. And our lives will be examined as He sees them. As His all-discerning eyes see them. Every disciple lives with the conscious reality of the Lord's ever-caring interest. Isn't that a comfort today? Maybe not if you're living in sin. But if you're trying to live in holiness and righteousness and be His disciple, isn't it a comfort today to understand He's watching and He cares? He's taking notice and He doesn't forget. He's watching. Secondly, here's number two. Being a disciple is not a popular position. Now again, the language is so important here, and again we have another imperfect tense going on in verse 41. He sat opposite. He was watching how the people put money in, and we read at the very end that many who were rich, they were putting in much. And again, it's an imperfect, so here they are. I don't know how long he sat. I don't know if it was minutes or hours. Mark doesn't put that element in because I think we are intended to look at it as an ongoing thing. He's watching, and notice what they're doing. All these wealthy people coming in just and putting. Just, you know, it's a cycle, and they're going through, and they're doing it over and over again. He's watching all these people just filing in with all their wealth, and they're putting them in, and the coins are just clanging away and making an awful racket. And maybe there were some standing there, and they're looking at what others are putting in, and they're judging based on that. And they're putting large sums and putting impressive things and putting what looks so respectable into these receptacles. They were putting in what looked spiritual. I love the fact we spent the whole morning contemplating what real fruit is. Sometimes what looks spiritual isn't always fruit. There's a huge contrast, though, when Mark describes this woman, because he makes it clear. He doesn't say a poor widow. He makes it very clear. He actually uses the word one poor widow. Just one. Doesn't sound very popular, does it? I mean, if I had the choice, naturally speaking, if I didn't know the end of the story, if I didn't have, you know, the last two verses of this little text, I'd be sitting here saying, boy, I wish I had lots to give like that. Wouldn't that look great? It's not popular. It's not always attractive to be a disciple. It might mean that you're going to have to deal with people you wouldn't normally want to deal with. And you're actually going to have to lower yourself lower than other disciples, other children of God, and actually serve them? Imagine that. It's not popular. It's not a position that everyone is clamoring for. And here is one poor widow against the many. And it wasn't like she took a heroic stand of any kind. She just came in and did what she did. She didn't make a big statement. She wasn't crying out and boasting about her faithfulness compared to... She wasn't saying, excuse me, but I'm putting in 100% here. 100% of everything. No, she just quietly came and did what she did. Just one. One out of the many. They were all putting. And in fact, when she comes along, it wasn't just one widow, but it was one act. Now it's the aorist tense, which means it was a historic event. This happened. She put in, just once, her little gift. Just one. I read Dietrich Bonhoeffer's biography a while back. It impressed me. What would it be like to stand up against the German Nazi machine in the name of Jews who Bonhoeffer believed very strongly God still had a place for them. And he stood up against those atrocities. It cost him his life to the point that the doctor who witnessed his execution said he had never seen a man die like that before, with such calm, knowing he was in the will of God. Just one against the many. Number three. Here's number three. Being a disciple. Oh, this one's not easy, but I have to give it. Being a disciple means a painful life. It's going to mean suffering. Three strikes against her. She was a woman. I'm sorry. We love our women. So society today is different than it was back then. But in society back then, they didn't have women's rights. They didn't have people crying out against injustices against women. In fact, there was an ancient, I thought it was a Jewish prayer that actually said, get this, you know, God, I'm thankful that I'm not a woman. Imagine that, you know. So don't get mad at me. I didn't say it. And I didn't pray it. Never prayed that. But she was a woman in a society where women were shunned and silenced. Jesus didn't treat women that way. Didn't treat children that way either. Society did. Secondly, she was a widow. She'd obviously experienced a few funerals in her life, and some very close to home. I don't know if she just lost a husband or she lost children as well. And thirdly, she was poor. She had no means to afford luxuries that we might have today in our society. But I want to make very clear, I want to make sure that we get this. I said painful. I didn't say joyless. Okay, there's a difference. I think sometimes we get them mixed up. We try to say, oh, you want to have a happy life? And we equate happiness with success. We equate happiness with comfort. That's not true. C.S. Lewis discovered this. He was searching for joy all his life. In fact, he wrote about it in a book, Surprised by Joy, because he kept searching for it as though it was a god. He was searching for it as though it was an end in itself, and it was always just out of his grasp. But when he found Christ, the joy came with it. And sometimes we think that, well, suffering equals joylessness. No, being a disciple means that we will have intense joy in spite of the suffering and in the suffering. But suffering is unavoidable. Dan Allender, who is a psychiatrist, a believer, who has written some masterpieces on the subject of abuse. He has written really the biblical response to abuse victims. And in one of his books, he said this. He said, what most of us spend the energy of our lives warring against is this reality, the fact that life is awful and the truth that this world is not our home. Do we live like that? That this world is not our home? He says, I am surprised when the effects of a fallen world impinge on my life. I know people die. I know tragedies occur. I am aware that people have affairs and marriages end. But for some reason, I am stunned when a good friend dies or a child of parents I know is diagnosed with a fatal disease. I'm shocked when someone I've worked with in ministry has an affair and leaves his wife. Though I face sin and its debris every day, I somehow assume that when I leave my office, I can drive away from sin's sorrow. There's no driving away from sin's sorrow in this world, especially if you're going to be a follower of the Lord Jesus. There's going to be suffering in your life. But listen, it's like Charles Dickens said in his title, it's the best of times, the worst of times. That you will face tragedies in life, and yet through those tragedies, God becomes more real and more powerful and greater in experience than ever before. This brings us right back to the cross, because in the cross we see this mixture of joy and sorrow, don't we? The Hebrew writer tells us it was for the joy that was set before him that he endured. What did he endure? He endured the pain, the suffering of the cross. He despised the shame. He is seated at the right hand of God. And through the cross and through the suffering, there was an element of joy, unspeakable joy. Well, here's number four. Being a disciple means there can be no partitions. No partitions. Now, I have to go beyond the English at this point. This is powerful. So I want you to try and follow. Verse 44, there is a tremendous statement. This is where he develops what he has just said. His whole point here is she put in more. Well, that doesn't make sense mathematically, does it? Because they were putting in an awful lot, and there were a lot of them, and they kept putting. And she comes along, does one thing, and he says, she put in more. Well, it needs some explanation. So verse 44 is the explanation. And as he writes, he says, she out of her poverty, she put in all that she had. And I want to stop right there, all that she had. In the original language, there are three words that are used here. Panta, hasa, and echen. Panta means all. Okay, all. Hasa means whatever, whichever. And echen means, well, it's the imperfect tense of having, to have, to hold. So let's put it together. Here's what it says. It doesn't make great English, but it's powerful. Okay. She put in all, whatever she was having. So on a continuous basis, notice how she made one act. And the Lord rewards her with an imperfect tense and says, whatever she was having, she put in. This was a lifetime. The Lord wasn't just watching her now. He has been watching her in her entire life. And whatever she was having. I find it incredible to think of this idea. First of all, everything. But secondly, whatever. It's not a term that we want teenagers using today because they don't use it right. But if we use it in this context, it is right. Whatever. Reminds me of the Stephen Curtis Chapman song that came out in the 90s that was entitled, Whatever. I am not my own, he sang. I'm yours and yours alone. You have bought me with your blood, Lord, to you. And you alone do I belong. And so, whatever you say, whatever, I will obey. Whatever, Lord, have your way. Because you are my God. And so, whatever. This is where it gets very heavy. Because I had a hard time even preparing this. I mean, C.T. Studd, he was a professional athlete and had a lot of money. He was a celebrity. He gave it all up to the missions and went himself into the missions. Left his wife behind at home for a long time. I don't understand it. But he did. He kept an account and he kept, I think it was like £10,000, which was a lot of money. It's a lot of money today, let alone back then, for his wife. He said, you know what, I'm going to give everything to myself, but this is for her. So here was this little bit, you know, Lord, don't touch this. And his wife said to him, no, we said we would give all. So give it all. I mean, am I saying that? I'm crying out to the Lord. Is there an area of my life? Sometimes it's hard to find. We need to wrestle with God over this. Are there areas of my life where I've built walls? Is there a hidden pride inside that I've never dealt with? Is there hidden sin somewhere? And I'm saying, no, this door is closed. Is there a bank account somewhere? And I'm saying, you can't have that. That's my security. Is there something that I'm saying, no, Abraham faced this. My son, my beloved, the one I love, the one you promised me. Whatever, I'll give it all. That's what it means to be his disciple. No partitions, just whatever. And it's a lifelong thing. I want to get to number five, being a disciple. It gets heavier and more intense, requires absolute surrender. There's a last statement here. It was all she had to live on. In verse 44, And again, it is so powerful. Mark wasn't repeating himself here. The Lord wasn't repeating himself here. Craig Evans, actually a scholar, paraphrased this very well. I want you to listen to what he said. "But she from her want has cast in all that she has." Listen to these words. "Her whole life." Perfect trust. It's not just, "Lord, whatever, take it all," but it's, "Lord, I'm resting it on you. Everything. Her whole life." I mean, you look at the coins she had, and I think we can draw the logical conclusion they were useless anyways. What are you doing with your life? I mean, it's just like a couple useless coins in itself. It's nothing. I mean, that's what the disciples in themselves proved. That's why I know the gospel accounts are true. One of the reasons is because they told some very embarrassing things about themselves. Very shameful things. It wasn't about them. We weren't to look to James or John or Peter or Andrew and say, "That's my hero. I want to base my life on them." No, it wasn't about them. They were just like a couple of coins, useless in themselves, but I'll give them to him because he can do something with them. Total dependence. Her whole life. She threw her whole life. Get the picture here. She threw her whole life into the treasury. Are you willing to throw in your whole life? I mean, your whole life? I'm not just talking all your days and in a matter of time. That's part of it. That's part of the picture. But I mean your whole life, who you are, everything about you. Are you willing to just throw it all? Say, "It's yours, and I'm trusting you with every part of who I am. And without that, I'm just a couple little coins." I want to get to the last one. Here's number 6. Being a disciple. Small things have great significance. Now, a leptos. Mark has to tell us what a leptos is. That's why he says two of them make basically a penny. In our language, maybe a penny. But a leptos, they were the smallest of all coins. I don't think too many people had them around. Here this lady comes in with these two very small coins. They were worth, each of them was worth about a 128th part of a denarius. You say, "That means nothing to me." A denarius was a day's wage. Most, I don't think, look at what you make in terms of a day. Usually it's like an hour, right? I make this much an hour or this much a year salary-wise. Not too many gauge it on, okay, this is how much I made in a day. But a denarius was a day's wage. I mean, do the math, all right? If everyone here made, let's say, $60,000 in a year, you just divide it out into a day's wage and then say 128th of that is about $1.28. Interpreted, next to nothing. Next to nothing. But Jesus says she put in more. I think one of the greatest attacks that Satan makes on disciples, and it doesn't matter who you are, what sphere of work you're in, believe me, preachers face this on a big scale. There are a lot of them sitting here today. Elders face this on a big scale. There's a lot of them sitting here today. Mothers face this on a great scale. There's a lot of you sitting here today. Doesn't matter where we are. Satan loves to tell us how insignificant our work for the Lord is. What was that about? I didn't change anything. Sunday school class. Week in, week out, kids not behaving again, par for the course. Here we go. Brace yourself. Small things. Satan says it's small, it's tiny. It's not worth anything. Big scale of history, what could it be? Susanna Wesley was quite a lady. She'd have to be. She had 19 children. John was number 15. And every week, Susanna Wesley spent time with each one of her children individually and taught them about the scriptures every single week. John Wesley, of course, we know, out of him came revival on a big scale. He was a great evangelist. Behind John Wesley was a mother who never gave up. And I know there are a lot of people sitting here today and you're wondering, what has my life been about? Last night, Mr. Colson was telling us about seniors. Looking back in your life and feeling the helplessness and maybe wondering, what difference did it make? What have I done? The Lord knows what you've done. And He will not forget the two little coins that were worth more than all that this world and its history has ever accomplished. At the end of the day, folks, being a disciple is about being close to the Lord Jesus. Because our work and bearing fruit, we were hearing about it this morning, just been talking about it in different terms. But at the end of the day, it's what makes our work valuable is that it is done in the Lord and by His power. And so, my beloved brothers and sisters, be steadfast, be immovable, and always be abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is most definitely not in vain.